additional weight measures, gradient. Thank you.
So thank you, Masha, and thank you. Well, thank you for the invitation and for this really nice workshop. It's really nice to be in a workshop where you talk a lot about surveillance. Normally, you're the only one talking about it. So I was asked also to speak a bit more about low-frequency gravitational waves or for LISA. So I will spend a bit time on that later on in the talk. But I also wanted kind of give an overview of gravitational wave signatures and surprise in general. You've heard already a lot on it during these 3 days. So most of it will be actually based on some of works that I've been doing in collaboration with Shobana Ghosh, she's a PhD student of Emmanuel Alberti, and with Enrico Barraus, Emmanuel Alberti, Vito Cardoso, also Irina Dvorkin, Antoine Klein. And so we've been working on, basically they were collaborating in these two papers that we published last year, and this paper also will speak a bit about it. I guess this is the right place to publicize this overview on superalliance that we've wrote some years ago. Actually, I was mostly here at PI when we wrote this review. It was published in 2015, and I think it's already outdated, which is a good thing. It means that the field has been, well, there's been a lot of things going on in the past 3 years. And so let me just start with, I don't need to motivate why this is interesting and why we are interested in basically ultralight bosons. I just wanted to show these plots that I've took from this paper by Vito Cardoso and collaborators. And basically this plot showed kind of constraints in the mass of axion-light particles and neutralite vector fields against these, the y-axis are couplings with standard model particles for these special axion-light particles and neutralite vector fields. It doesn't really matter which kind of coupling, these are just different experiments, the kind of constraint that they put.
So the curves for LSW and CAS, for example, there's a horizontal line, does it extend all the way to the left?
You mean this one?
Yes, for CAS it goes all the way.
Yeah, I think it does, yeah.
Yeah, because they're just, it's solar axions, so they are high energy axions and the mass doesn't matter, basically, so it just extends.
Red region here is supposed to be exclusion region, or is
no, so red region, yeah, I was going to explain. The red region just means basically the, so it's 10 to the minus 11, roughly 10 to the minus 20, roughly like, will be basically the range that can be proved by black hole superalliance if you have black holes between 5 solar masses up to, the, let's say, 10 to the 10 solar masses. Assuming that you have black holes all the way, of course, if you have gaps in between, there could be regions where you cannot prove them. But the idea here was just to show basically in these kind of plots what black hole superalliance can give you in terms of and constraints, but most importantly, so it does fill a gap that cannot be proved by other experiments, but I think most importantly, it doesn't need to couple to standard matter particles to give you constraints. So while all these experiments basically rely on having some, I think all of them rely on having couplings to standard matter particles, this black hole superalliance is just a purely gravitational effect, so there's, by the equivalence principle, this particle must couple minimally to gravity, and so it will happen if you have these ultralight bosons. Of course, here they put these constraints up to very large, like these are the couplings to standard model particles. I think this place I will have put a bit more like fuzzy because the phenology that we've been talking about and I will talk about in this talk will basically assume that these are massive fields that are not coupled to any other particle. But if you include couplings and self-interaction, which are large enough, all the phenology of black hole superalliance could change. And perhaps you would still have like signatures that could be, but I think this area is still an area that's...
For instance, for vectors with charges one.
Sorry?
For vectors with charges one, like coupled is four, like for photon, there is probably nothing, right? Because
even there, above 10 to the minus, if you, 10 to the minus, minus 12 there in log scale, which is towards the minus, because there, above that, you won't even have superalliance.
Right, that's true, yeah. I will, basically this plot will be kind of cut here. It's not true that it will, like, extend up to
a Harry triangle. But it's complementary to gravitate to other experiments, because there you need large coupling, here you actually want small coupling.
Right. Yeah, it works better if actually there's no coupling at all.
That's
will be the ideal scenario. So of course I don't need Rolla. Once more, I just will show this slide just to tell you what superinance and to recall you. I guess you all know by now what superinance is just a extraction a way to extract energy from a spinning black hole. It's a very generic process that happens in many scenarios in nature. In this case, in specific. Case, or imagine that you have a Kerr black hole rotating with some angular velocity, omega h, and you have some monochromatic wave with some fixed frequency omega. M is just the azimuthal number. And so this would only have superinance only happens for non-spherically symmetric wave packets. And if this condition is met, which basically is just if you this is roughly the angular velocity of these wave packets. So if the angular velocity of the wave packet is smaller than the angular velocity of the black hole horizon, you have this process where by scattering bosonic waves, you can extract energy and angular momentum from the black hole. And in the process, you amplify these waves. This actually, very recently, last year, this paper was published where they in the University of Nottingham, in the group by Silke Weinfurter group, they built this tank of with just water, and they basically have a vortex in the middle of this tank, and they just in this vortex actually work exactly as a completely analog of a Kerr black hole. It does have an energy region, does have a region where surface waves cannot. Basically, get out so an effective horizon inside this vortex, and basically in their experiment they just throw in surface waves. So this is a 2D experiment in reality, and just measure the flux of waves that comes out divided by the flux that they sent in, and they basically compute what will be the reflection factor, so the amplification factor of these waves. And this is for a fixed frequency. So without vortex mean that you don't have, you just throw in without having the basically this effective black hole, analog black hole. So here, this reflection is always smaller than one. So basically everything is, there's no super radiance. And while here for m equal one, m equal two, they do see basically reflection factor bigger than one. These effectively basically waves that are being amplified. Of course, with some error bars, I think these are one sigma error bars. And so this was just to say that it's actually a very generic process. You can have actually observe it nowadays in the laboratory for these analog black holes. Something that was already mentioned here, but I wanted to emphasize again, which is The amplification factors actually depend on the spin of these waves. They were for the first time computed by Preston and Tucholsky back in the 70s. So these are just a fraction, basically the fraction of energy the fractional amplification of the waves, of these waves packets after reflection, after scattering of the black hole. For different kind of waves, or scalar waves, electromagnetic ones, and gravitational waves, massless waves. Here for spin 0.99, and you get basically a much higher amplification factors for gravitational than you get for scalar. So in general, basically amplification factors grow with the spin. For gravitational waves, you can get up to roughly 100% of amplification. Scalar waves, roughly 4%, and well, electromagnetic waves, roughly 14%. All these computations were done basically at the linear regime, where you basically perturb the space-time. There was a talk by Franz Pretorius there where he showed actually completely nonlinear evolution of this process. They get slightly smaller efficiency, I believe, and due to basically nonlinear effects, but but the results are consistent with the basically the linear analysis. And here I just wanted to show, for example, all these changes with the spin, like the larger the spin, the bigger is the amplification factor that you can get. And this here, the lines drop exactly at the point where the supervariance condition is basically satisfied, where basically this is equal to this, instead of being an inequality, this is basically these lines, yeah. Okay, so now with, well, that's also just a review of what has been said in this conference. If you confine, so you have this process of supergradients, and now imagine that you can confine these waves in some way, just, for example, put a mirror around it. If you have this process that is extracting energy from the black hole, and this process continuously happens continuously by just reflection of a mirror, for example, you'll have this process. You'll have this supergradient instability where the black hole will continuously lose spin, and you'll have the wave packet that will grow exponentially in time. And we all know by now that massive bosonic fields provide exactly these confinements for low frequency waves. Here, low frequency means frequencies below the mass of the boson in some units. And basically, that means that spinning black holes or Kerr black holes are unstable against massive bosons, whatever they spin, either scalar or vector or massive spin two, if you want. And it has already been said that this, for astrophysical black hole, is mostly relevant when this parameter, so this is the mass of the black hole, the mass of the boson, just divided by the Planck mass square. So this also can be written as the ratio between the size of the black hole and the Compton wavelength of the particle. When this is order one, actually order 0.5. So for example, for 10 solar mass black hole, this is it's mostly relevant for 10 to the minus 11 electron volt. And for supermassive black holes, if you put 10 to the 6, for example, this will be mostly relevant for 10 to the minus 16 electron volt particle. So there's been a lot of work in this. We already heard by Sam Dolan. There's been a lot of work on the supergradient instability and computing basically timescale for this instability. I wanted to give you kind of a unified picture in terms of just basically showing you this plot. I did this plot a couple of years ago when basically what was known was only the spin zero case. At the time, there was computations for spin one and spin two only in the slow rotation regime, so where you basically only consider perturbations on top of a slow rotating Kerr black hole, and the reason why in this regime you can separate the equations and do computations. There's been some developments in the last basically year where the for the massive spin two case, the rates were computed exactly for any spin. That actually Sam already told us about. But the point here is that basically, so basically this is actually positive here because I'm showing you the absolute value. So this region here, basically omega, m omega I, so basically it's negative, which means this basically gives you the decay timescale. If you have such a massive bosonic field around a Kerr black hole, these points here represent the point where supergradient instability is exactly, well, it's basically saturated, exactly equal, where omega over m is exactly equal to omega h. And on this side of the plot, basically omega m omega I becomes positive, which means basically this, because of this time dependence, these fields become exponentially unstable. Well, they become unstable, they are unstable, and grow exponentially in time. So the spectrum is basically roughly given by kind of a hydrogenic kind of spectrum. There's correction, of course. Here I just put the first leading order for this frequency. We've seen that there's correction, which related to the binding energy of these fields. But roughly speaking, the frequency of these waves is when they are in these bound states, it's roughly speaking the mass of the field. While this frequency is basically given by some power of alpha, with a coefficient basically that, as you see, is basically the supergradient factor, and when this number is positive, when the supranet condition is met, basically you have these instabilities. And the reason,
So in the previous slide you had spin 2, so that's presumably some modified theory of gravity?
I will not spend much time on spin 2. So spin 1 and spin 0 are well motivated, we have heard about it. Spin 2, you will need, there's some theories like nonlinear massive gravity theories that will, where you will have massive spin 2 fields. As far as I know, they're not really well motivated and they're problematic in some regions. But you can just solve these equations, which are, there's no problem with a massive spin to a field on Kerr, like on a Kerr background, and you can solve it in principle. Whether then you have a nonlinear, full nonlinear theory that is consistent, that's another question. And I've heard also, I think probably you know more, that it's unnatural actually to produce massive, very light massive spin to fields on like, well, there's no mechanism for it, so it's not. For example, if they come from like Kaluza-Klein reduction, we'll have actually very massive spin to fields, and not ultralight as you want. But you can just phenomenologically say, well, imagine that you will have such a spin to field, and you could just compute the rates, and etc.
What's the last question?
This one, sorry.
In this first interview case,
this is just so the massive spin to field must basically satisfy this set of equations always. This is just a constraint that massive spin to field satisfies. Basically, if you want, it's just such that massive spin to fields have 5 degrees of freedom. So 2s plus 1 is the number of degrees of freedom, and they must, so this is actually not the full equation. So in this equation, I'm already imposing that. Diversionless and traceless, but they must satisfy these conditions. These are constraints that show up naturally if you want to when you write down the equation. In the same way that actually massive spin 1 always satisfies this Lorentz condition. Okay, now you have this instability, and you what happens is basically this field still keeps growing, and we've seen in previous talks that basically at some point instability saturates the supranet condition, because the black hole loses spin, and at some point you reach basically this kind of equilibrium between the cloud and the spinning black hole, where the cloud and the black hole are basically co-rotating with each other. This is kind of a tidal locking effect, if you want. And so you can have this formation of long-lived bosonic condensates, actually.
Sorry, you cannot have that. That's not a realistic situation.
Sorry?
Right? Those are not realistic situations.
You mean?
Yes, the Carlos simulation.
Oh, yeah, I'm not saying it's realistic. I'm just saying if you can construct the solutions. That's what I wanted to say. You can construct the solutions if you have complex, if you put complex
yes,
fields in.
Yes, but there is no way here. You can get this astrophysics.
Sure. I will not claim that.
Yeah.
I just wanted to say that in GR, if you had complex field, you do have truly stationary solutions.
Classical level.
Classic, yeah.
Yeah, it's a classical level. And they're most likely unstable. And so there was a lot of simulations. Well, there was a couple of simulations in the past few years that we already heard, and I took the liberty of kind of stealing these plots to put them near just to show you basically how the instability grows non-linearly, completely non-linearly. And well, this is just the mass in the cloud and the spin. We have seen these plots yesterday, and they grow basically. The point that I wanted to bring here that I think will be important later in my talk is basically that the fraction of energy that you can extract is roughly the maximum is roughly 10%, and it's only a fraction of percent of the total mass of the black hole, which is quite a lot if you think about it. A couple of years ago, so 3 years ago, we kind of basically did kind of because this happens in a very slowly, you can kind of do a adiabatic approximation of the evolution, where you basically just compute the fluxes at the horizon and you just evolve basically the mass and the spin parameter of a Kerr black hole that slowly evolves through the evolution. You just plug in the numbers and you'll get exactly or very similar results. And the reason is because this all is always in a kind of a linear regime. Even though you, even at the end of the spray instability, the cloud doesn't really. Well, first, everything is very slow, so you can do the adiabatic approximation. And second, considering a scalar field on the background of a Kerr black hole is always a very good approximation because a scalar cloud never sources a very strong curvature, even at the end of the spray instability. And the reason is because it's really extended, even though it can be very massive, so tens of percent of the black hole, of black hole mass, it's very extended, so the curvature is never really large. And so now you have this cloud around the black hole, and of course, we know that by now that there will be a source of gravitational waves. There's been basically some, we've been given some kind of particle physicist point of view, so I just wanted to, let's say, give a classical GR point of view why you do have these waves from purely classical reasons. So imagine that you have only one level. So of course, here will be a sum over Lm if you have different Lm modes. But imagine that you only have, like, for example, the dominant L equal M mode. And you have, I put epsilon is just a bookkeeping parameter if you want, but it's roughly, it's the amplitude of the field. And if you plug in this in the stress energy tensor of the scalar field, schematically, you'll get basically things which are the square of the amplitude of the field. And you'll have this time-varying stress energy tensor, which is non-spherically symmetric, because these. So if you have, for example, a dipole here, the stress energy tensor will be mostly quadrupolar. And so you'll source basically mostly quadrupolar gravitational waves. And so if you do perturbation theory, you'll have, so this first term will be just like this, GR in vacuum, and then you'll have these corrections to the scalar field that second, which come in the square of the scalar field. That's just schematic. And this, we know how to solve this. This is just basically linear gravitational waves with a source term, which is basically the T mu given by the scalar field. And so, and this, we can do that because the Bragg reaction on the scalar field is always small. So you can use basically compute everything in a Kerr geometry and then do perturbation theory on top of it. And so you can basically accurately compute the gravitational wave signal using only perturbation theory. In principle, there's no real need for numerical relativity, which is good because they are computationally expensive to prove the whole parameter space. Okay, so that's just pictures to give you numbers that I've already been given here also, but I wanted to give them again to recall you all these works. So basically, so you have the spray instability that happens in a time scale roughly 10 to, well, the minimum, the most extreme case, it happens in a time scale of 10 to the 7 m. And then you have gravitational emission that happens in a longer time scale, also in the most extreme case. And so these two timescales are actually quite disparate. So it's basically kind of the system evolves. First, you have the super instability, and then you dissipate the cloud in gravitational waves in a longer timescale. And the frequency is roughly given basically by the mass of the boson. For example, here, because I will be talking about in the Lisa band, I put like a 10 to the minus 17 electron volt, which will be exactly inside the Lisa band. And I put some numbers here just for you to see for a 15 solar mass black hole, for example, what this means in terms of the frequency and the mass and the stability time scale. It happens, well, it's really a peak, it depends a lot on the mass of the boson for a fixed black hole mass, and of course depends on the initial spin of the black hole. And you can put the same thing for these for the duration of the signal, if you want, the rough duration of the signal, and you, like, that it does happen on much longer time scales. And if you want, in some case, it can be even much larger than the edge of the universe. And if you want to basically other black hole masses, just multiply these numbers by the black hole mass. Everything scales linearly with the black hole mass. Okay, so now going a bit more to observations, observational effects of gravitational wave signatures of these. I wanted first to basically kind of a couple of years ago we did. Well, as I said, we did these evolutions, these adiabatic evolutions of supraring instability. And at the time, well, first we were just interested in supermassive black holes just to see all the instability. There was no real, when we did the paper, that wasn't observationally motivated, just to put the numbers and see what happens. And we did these adiabatic evolutions where we also included basically accretion. So you have a slow accretion that happens basically at the it's in the Eddington equilibrium, and you have this F Eddington basically that gives you roughly the larger is this number, the faster is the rate of accretion. Basically, that's why here, if you look at these planes, spin versus mass, if you don't look inside these holes, here all black holes are massively spinning because we basically evolved thousands of massive black holes randomly distributed in this space and just let them evolve. So outside the region where these black holes are surprisingly unstable, they just go to maximum spin because we didn't. I should say, it's a very non-realistic situation where accretion happens continuously. But we let basically the system evolve, letting accretion do like continuously give mass and spin to the ball. And if you have very low accretion, you never really, you don't have time to basically maximum spin the black holes.
Do you know how much is known about the growth of supermassive black holes?
Yeah, well, it's going to be my next slide. I think next slide. But the point here was to show that in principle, it's kind of independent of the accretion rate that you always get these holes. Because you can have roughly different scenarios, but they are roughly always the same, independently on the accretion rate. And the reason is just because in this region, basically it's the region where the stability timescale is smaller than the accretion timescale. They become a bit smaller, the larger is the accretion timescale. But it's a very generic, very strong prediction of this is that you'll have these holes, these gaps in the mass versus plane, mass versus spin plane of massive black holes. So when we did that, of course, we chose kind of a very non-physical distribution for these massive black holes, and actually we are interested in supermassive black holes. We started to speak with Enrico Barros about this, and he has models of basically evolutions of massive black hole spin and mass evolution. And the reality is that evolution in general is really messy. So you have mergers, supermassive black holes grow mainly by mergers and accretion, mostly by accretion. But you do have mergers in between. So everything is very messy and very uncertain. But people have been working a lot on basically models to try to model the evolution of these of supermassive black holes. These models always have some free parameters that you can calibrate to data. I'm not an astrophysicist, so I cannot give you full details about it. I will just show you.
What are the contours here?
Yeah, we'll.
Okay.
So here, this is this model by Enrico Barros predicts.
Yeah.
For a specific choice of the model, there's a lot of different model. Like in the same model, you can depending on the type of galaxies, etc., things change a bit.
And the previous slide, you have these red crosses. So these are.
Sorry. So
these are interpretations, but.
These were just data that we put on the plot just to.
Actual data?
Yeah, actual data.
How robust is spin determination?
Javier. AGNs for spin measurements.
Yeah, error bars on points. What is the actual size?
Very, very difficult. I only trust a handful of them. I mean, there is a list of maybe 20 that people say they're reliable, I will reduce at least to maybe 5 or 6 that I trust.
Yeah, so we
try it actually if you get us the list of the ones.
Yeah, so very funny. when we wrote the paper with Masha a few years ago, we tried to take that data and extrapolate what the constraint would be, similar the way we did for X-ray binaries.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, we couldn't find the bound was going away because the error bars were so large. There was no bound within the 90% confidence level.
But
so
this is compilation made by Chris Reynolds where he said, well, this is the number of EGNs that I trust,
mm-hmm.
But that's not really based on the error bars. It's mostly based on what he thought, you know, how reliable the data analysis was, you know,
mm-hmm.
how much effort was put in, how consistent it was and all that. But yeah, you're right, some of those, the error bars are just going to be pretty large. And I'm sure if we go back to those and you do a proper error analysis,
yeah.
it'll be more like upper limits, not really.
But these are all iron lines, right?
Yeah.
There's no continuum fitting method. There's no continuum fitting determinations for EGNs.
Yeah.
There are a couple of papers of where they claim they can do it, but it's much more difficult. Yeah.
Okay. The points you have here, are they the same data or are they simulation points?
No, these are data actually, points that they took, I think, from EGNs.
Okay.
Or robust they are or not, I guess. We don't
also say I will also say that precisely because of that distribution, they're already talking about, you know, an AGN that is a more clear observational bias.
Okay.
Because we will see mostly the ones that are brighter because of the accretion efficiency, you know. So we expect to see mostly the ones that are spinning rapidly. Not the ones that are, if they're not spinning rapidly, then the accretion disk is not that close, then they're not going to be as bright, and then we're not going to see them.
Yeah.
It's clearly biased, but it's not clear how to correct for that bias.
Right.
Really,
there
are a lot of small factors.
Sometimes people say that just because we see jets from AGNs, that means that it should be rapidly rotating. How robust that statement is.
I think that comes from the Blanford Sinai kind of picture, and that, as far as I understand, hasn't been proven, right? So actually, normally the radio, if I remember correctly, the radio loud AGNs are, we don't see much of reflection from it. So I guess I haven't thought much about it, but I don't know what that means.
Well, and further on that point, actually, for the binaries, the high-spinning black holes, SIGX-1 and JIRIS-1915 produce strong jets, but so does the lowest-spinning black hole with essentially zero spin. So it might be that you have different mechanisms producing spin in different scenarios, or producing jets, rather. But, I mean, notably, protostars have jets, neutron stars have jets, and they have low spin, so jets exist in a lot of scenarios. It might be different mechanisms. It might just be that
it's sidetracked.
Keep going for it.
Yeah. So in these plots, basically, it's kind of what these models predict. These models by Enrico Barros, that there was further developments after this paper, but basically spin versus the mass of the black holes at a given redshift for some specification of the model. Actually, I don't remember, but. The point is that they get the spins in these models, and in general the spins must be quite high, just because otherwise they cannot. You do need a lot of accretion to basically be able to form these very supermassive black holes starting from low mass seeds, and accretion basically in general we tend to spin up the black holes. So in general these models always predict very kind of a distribution skewed towards high spins.
Does it depend on whether it's accretion or mergers?
Yeah.
So mergers in general doesn't really spin up the black holes. The mergers will. The mergers are not enough, as far as I understood. They are not enough to really. If you only put mergers, you will not get these very massive black holes.
So you need to accrete.
You need to accrete, and you need to accrete a superinnicton at the beginning of the, which is also far as I understand.
The other thing is because there's this King model you may have heard,
mm-hmm.
that predicts like a very different spin distribution, that they are
mm-hmm.
slowly rotating. In this, does it matter? Because usually you will spin up if the accretion happens in the same direction.
Yeah.
And versus is there any consensus?
Yeah. So in these models, they have like both are in the model. So they need both to be able like to basically to have these. So the reality is the model has three parameters where they put this chaotic accretion, like coherent accretion, and basically then they fit these parameters to try to fit these points, and that's what they get from the model. Yeah, so in general, spins in these particular models are always quite high.
I see.
Whether then you can trust the data points, that's another.
No, of course, but.
And the model also will predict basically the mass function, how many black holes you have in a given mass bin,
mm-hmm.
as a function of mass. The mass function is actually quite, these different lines are different redshifts, what the model predicts, and these contour lines are basically data, so what the constraints that you get from data. So at least, I think up to 2017, there wasn't any really constraints on low mass, like below 10 to the 6 low mass, roughly. So there's a lot of uncertainty in this range. I took this figure from this paper where they study rates for extreme mass ratio in spirals, where the rates are very uncertain mainly because of this.
Mm-hmm.
So this will be a very pessimistic model, and then you have different models. Okay, so now if you want to, like for example, imagine measuring mergers with LISA, there's also a lot of uncertainties in the merger rates, and the merger rates are mainly what the uncertainty and mainly dominated by actually what's the seed for the initial, all these black holes grow. So how do they start, what's the initial basically condition for this, for the growth of these massive black holes? And there's different basically proposals of what's the initial seed of these black holes. Some of them, for example, are basically pop 3 stars, so low metallicity stars, that very heavy stars that collapse and form really massive black holes. So roughly like orders of 100,000 of solar mass, and then you from there you grow through accretion and mergers, and from what nowadays the very massive supermassive black holes that you have nowadays. But there's also models that will predict, for example, will say that the seeds of these supermassive black holes are actually really heavy, so 10 to the 5 solar mass protogalactic disks from the instability of very early basically galaxies.
So this plot show number of
yeah,
mergers,
so this,
binaries.
Mm-hmm. So this plot
shows
basically the merger rates, not the ones that will be seen, just all the mergers that happen as a function of redshift, and depending on the model, for example, the peak will be at different redshifts, or for prop 3 stars will be around 8. And these two different models are heavy, basically heavy seeds, but with delays between, so you do have like the galaxies merging, but then in principle you have the delay between the merger of the galaxy and the merger of the supermassive black hole, and depending whether this delay, they put the delay in the model or not, you have very different predictions for the merger rates. So if you do have delay in these very heavy seeds, you'll have really few mergers. It's a really huge, so there's really a big uncertainty, and also the mass, well, the as a function of mass, depending on the type of model, the masses, the mergers will happen for very different supermassive black holes.
So these are things that will be visible by LISA?
Mm-hmm. So that's why I have these next slides. So the way that you will see these mergers, very supermassive black holes, they will produce, basically, they will emit very low frequency gravitational waves. And so for that, we cannot use LIGO. Because they will produce waves which are below 1 Hertz. And so we need something else, and the proposal that you all know, it's basically to send gravitational wave detectors to space. And The proposal was actually selected last year, so it's going to happen for sure. And the launch at the moment, I think the expected launch is 2034. And Lizzie is now becoming a full consortium. You can join. I think so you can join if you want. It's going to become. It's becoming really a full collaboration, a LIGO-style collaboration. And we know for sure that now it's not a science fiction anymore. And basically, this is the configuration that is in the LISA proposal. It's a quite, really an amazing thing. If you look at the numbers, so millions of, it's a 2.5 million kilometers arms. Well, that you need to basically detect very low frequency that is going around the sun, behind, like following the orbits around the Earth.
What are the MRIs?
Sorry?
What are the MRIs? EMRI harmonics.
Yeah, let me explain this plot now.
Sorry.
And this is all the kind of sources that I expected to be detected by LISA. So typical characteristic strain of these sources versus frequency, and this is the LISA instrument noise, so this green line. And so these curves here are basically massive black holes at some redshift that they choose the different masses. So depending on the mass, you do see more of the merger, inspiral. Well, you see more of the inspiral depending on the specific mass of these binaries. The ideal will be around 10 to the 5. Solar mass is right in the bucket of LISA. MRI, and the extreme mass ratio inspirals. Which will have much more SNRs, but and are very uncertain, like the rates are very uncertain, and there's a lot of uncertainty on them. But in principle, LISA could also detect supermassive black, basically solar stellar mass black holes, or like falling into supermassive black holes. And you can do amazing science with them. So interestingly, so there was a better design pointed out after GW1409, the first event, that you could also detect LIGO-type binary black early in spiral of LIGO-type binary black holes. In principle, I think with not really large SNR, but you could basically, I think was pointed out in the previous talk, use it and points, and if you have a ground detector on Earth, basically tell them when the merger will happen, which is quite an amazing thing. And this curve is basically, so you have a lot of mainly white dwarfs binaries in the galaxy, and the noise coming from basically all the gravitational waves from these binaries, you will see some of them, but a lot of them are too weak to be detected basically, but they will basically sum up incoherently and form a really big noise. And so these dashed black line are basically when you include the noise, the gravitational wave noise coming from, which is called sometimes the foreground, the white dwarf foreground, will actually add up to the noise of the instrument itself. So and it will basically be in this range of frequencies. And the amazing thing with this is that LISA will detect these binary, massive binary black holes, which really huge SNR, completely, like, could be thousands of. You could do really precise, very precise science. And so this plot kind of summarizes all this. So the idea of this plot is basically these Reggie planes, so these gaps in the mass versus spin plane for spin zero particles. Here the lines were chosen such that the stability time scale, I think it's 150 mega years, I don't remember, but. And these, so all these are some, well, EM, basically, so measurements of the spin and mass coming from XM binaries. These are AGNs. You have LIGO black holes here. Here, you see that this spin actually seems small, but these are the final black hole spin, which is measured very well. But all the measurements from the mergers, like the spin of the weaver that you cannot measure very well, so LIGO basically these huge error bars. And these are basically simulated binaries that LISA will see, depending on the model, on these three models that I talked about in the previous slides. And depending whether it's POP3, you will see like kind of less massive black holes and these no delay, these Q3, so heavy seeds with delay, with delays between galaxy merger and black holes will very, will basically see only a few of merger, few mergers, which will be like very pessimistic, see a very pessimistic situation. But they will basically range in a kind of a very complementary to what LIGO and AGNs can do. They will basically see black holes which between 10 to the 3 solar mass up to 10 to the 6, 7 solar masses.
Richard, do you know, so the LIGO spin measurements here are the spin measurements from actual LIGO, right?
So it's 90%.
So, yeah, no, but it doesn't account for any additional spin information from LISA.
No, yeah, so I will have a comment on that,
yeah.
I think, okay. Yeah. But yeah, so, before spoiling the thing, I think in the future, LISA, besides all these black holes, since it will see some binary black holes, it could help also front generation detectors to really measure very well spins off of stellar mass black holes. I don't think there's much work on that, but I think it would be a nice thing to see, like how exactly the get numbers and do similar plots for these stellar mass black holes, adding like LISA. But all these things that we've been hearing about measuring spins basically being very hard with LIGO will not be true with LISA. So LISA will really measure.
But I see that the brown points, for example, the points we have, so LISA, they go all the way 10 to the 3, 10 to the 5 solar masses, right?
Mm-hmm.
This is a regime where we have not detected anything yet, right?
Yeah.
Essentially, it's a very tricky issue. Right?
So that's why also the merger rates are so uncertain. Everything is so uncertain because we haven't seen like anything, of course, in this range, like 10 to the 5. But you do in these models. You do need them, otherwise you don't form supermassive black holes.
No, I agree. It's not.
So in principle, they should be there.
A bit of what the simulations show. So in the plots that you showed, you had a cut because of the pop 3 stars at there,
mm-hmm.
And then they start at 10 to the 4. Okay.
Yeah. Exactly. So the bucket for pop 3 stars will be like 10 to the 4. So that's why it's kind of less massive.
Yeah.
This it's more or less the same masses, but one.
But all the codes predict some population there, right?
Yeah, all the codes predict some population because you need to start with some seeds at those masses.
Yeah,
of course, they will like the low mass case are mostly at high redshifts, not close to not world, right? Because you start with these high seeds and they merge and then become like in the local universe you'll have mostly. Supermassive black holes. Like,
this heavy seeds model, the seeds is really, really very high redshift. It's like 10.
Yeah, so I think the seeds always start between 15 and 20.
Right.
So that they start always these models, basically starting the evolution.
Are we assuming that the starting black hole spin is high or low?
The initial
spin. Yeah, do you know?
So the initial spin, I don't know actually. I think it doesn't really matter, at least after redshift. 15, 10, it doesn't really matter in terms of, here it doesn't say what the seed, for example, because you can, after some low redshifts, you kind of forget what the seed was.
Ah, okay.
So at the end, you always end up with the same kind of, roughly, I think in this paper, if I'm not wrong, they show, for example, mass function, and the spin distribution is more or less the same at low redshifts. It's just like the initial seed can change the merger rate, but it doesn't change the spin and mass distribution.
Today,
yes. Or slow redshifts. Mainly because after you have accretion, because at some point accretion is right drives everything, kind of, and so accretion for like completely forgets about really what was the initial state.
So I was just going to say that if the pop 3 seeds are a big contribution to the black hole growth, then those will be easily and observable by the 3G ground based detectors.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, that's true.
So, and at all possible redshifts.
Yeah.
The very highest mass ones might be redshifted out of the sensitivity bands, even for like ET and so on. But like at least a few hundred solar masses should be trivial to
your No, yeah, I mean, yeah, I mean, by the time of this list is online, you'll probably, hopefully, at some point, third generation, more or less at the same time, you'll, well, all these will not be on terms of these anymore.
When you did the adiabatic, so axions can help with growth, right?
So, yeah, at some point, I wanted to leave it out of the comments, but something that we never check, I would like to check eventually and ask perhaps Enrico.
Add an axiom to these codes. And
add the axiom to the code and see how all things change.
Yeah, exactly.
Because it's kind of computationally expensive to do this. We never really did it. We just basically see what the models give us and roughly say, well.
Are you sure? Okay. Well, but no, ours is a bit more analytic, but.
We can
because the point is that axions, because they spin down the black hole, the accretion becomes much more
efficient.
So they can help with growth of
although holes. If there's an axion only in this, I mean, it will be.
It depends on where the mass is, right?
Yeah, if you, it will like because it's only a some range of masses that it will actually.
Exactly.
So
exactly.
So it's not.
So it depends, or whether it's probably if it's close to the mass that would be affected for POP 3 stars, probably between 10 to the mass 13, 10 to the mass 14, or something, the effect will be bigger. But yeah, we don't. I mean.
Oh yeah. Yes.
Yeah. But it would be nice if you were to, yeah.
Yeah, I think that would be a very nice step because from that you will also get much better, for example, estimates for gravitational wave events, etc.
Exactly.
Because everything will be included.
Yeah.
I think that will be a very nice step to afterwards. So because LISA can measure so well black hole masses and spins, you can. So we did roughly a kind of it's a Bayesian model comparison, which was very simple. Was basically the idea was you have one model where you have bosons, one model where you don't have bosons. If you have bosons, basically these gaps, all these black holes here will basically go down and kind of sit in the threshold lines. Because using the Bayesian model, Bayesian statistics, you can include all the errors and spins and mass.
Can you go back to the previous plot? Something I noticed, some of the error bars there, this is simulated data.
Yes, this is simulated data.
So it looks like some of the high spin ones have larger error bars than the spinning ones.
Yeah,
in the brand, forget about LIGO for a second. If you go to the LISA band,
example.
Or the brown, look at the brown
dots.
So then the bottoms have very small error bars in the spinning, while at the top of the plot there are more error bars. Why is that?
I see your point. So think, well, first here it's the two progenitors of the merger, and normally there's one more massive, one less massive.
Yeah.
So the most more massive, you measure it
very
well, while the other you don't measure that well.
Oh, it depends on Q.
It depends on Q. And I'm not sure why, for example, they seem to be.
Yeah, this is like tiny spin, and then the error bar is tiny.
Yeah, I'm not sure about that, actually. So these, because this basically was done like in the paper by Antoine Klein, so I think it's Antoine Klein and Michael Bagaus, that they did these computations for merger rate of supermassive black holes that they wanted to include in the LISA proposal, and then we just used those results. So I'm not sure exactly about the details of why.
Is it a fair statement that to appreciably change the spin, you need to have a mass ratio that's close-ish to one?
You mean after merger?
For the merger, the progenitors.
For the progenitors, no.
No.
No, it depends on the history, because this would happen whether the black holes are isolated or not, right? So,
oh, I'm sorry, I mean the two black holes that merge, do they have to have a mass ratio close to one to
spin up?
To spin up, I mean, because the only way that you get the long-lived super radiance events is if you have sort of a big spin up and then it can spin down, right?
Right.
Otherwise, if you're just doing sort of these incremental changes, it'll just always hover at an equilibrium point.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Exactly.
Probably you need something like that, some violent event where you get a big kick from the orbital angle of momentum. That sounds right.
Yeah, I agree.
I mean, if you're just kind of smoothly accreting onto the black hole, it'll keep super radiant.
No, he's talking about, forget about accretion.
Oh,
he's asking the following question. If you have these black holes merging, and they will already been affected to some level by the axion, right? So they're spun down. In order for you to be able to get a big kick in the spin after the merger, you need to have something that's close in mass so that your orbital momentum spins you up. So yeah, I think that's a correct statement.
So putting all this together, the kind of constraints that you will get if you measure all this off, basically, I think this was simulating different observation times. So the more time you look at it, the more mergers you see. It grows with time, but doesn't grow that much. And the reason is your constraint is kind of easy. You see a couple of bicycles here, and you constrain it already. Because the model just predicts that there shouldn't be any bicycle, unexplained bicycle. So, and the reason why, for example, Q3 here starts a bit later is basically because this model predicts less mergers, so you need to wait more time to constrain it, to basically see black holes merging. But the constraints could be depending on the models, of course, but could go range from 10 to the minus 13 to 10 to the minus 18, which is a really big range and very complementary to all the rest, as I was pointing out. And here I added this note that we already mentioned. It's here we only consider supermassive black holes, but it will be nice to do exactly the same thing to see what happens when you join LISA with third generation detectors and see what kind of constraints that you could get at larger axial masses. Because I believe that the spin measurements will be much better than what is correct. I just wanted to say that this was for spin zero, but you can do exactly the same for spin one. And Masha and Robert and Del, I don't know your first names.
May.
May.
It's right there.
They wrote a paper on that, and there was also Vito Cardoz and collaborators. They also estimated. They also did exact. Computations of the rates and also use that to basically say what one could say with spin one. Roughly speaking, spin one are unstable in much smaller timescales, so you can constrain them much better than spin zero in general because these gaps are much larger. I don't have the numbers, but I mean everything here is kind of is very similar. I think one interesting question to ask it will be whether imagine that you do detect something, whether this you could do. Use the detection to actually measure the spin somehow. I'm not sure how that will work, but I think there could be possibilities to use these using, for example, model comparison to try to infer not only the mass of the axion or the boson, but also its spin, for example, because the gaps are very different for different spins. And just a comment that in principle, you can do the same for massive spin to fields, let's say massive gravitons, but as I say, they were less well-motivated, but just playing with the rates that you can compute, the instability time scales that you can compute, that we computed 2013, you can also use the same kind of arguments to try to constrain them. So this was one of the gravitational wave signatures. We already heard about basically direct continuous wave emissions. So this plot tried to summarize basically everything in one plot. These lines, so this is the strain, the amplitude of the gravitational of the continuous gravitational wave as a function of the frequency for different masses of the boson of a it's a scalar field. Here I've plotted the sensitivity curves for LISA and LIGO and the Siegelwald proposed. A detector in Japan that could fill the gap between those two, the LISA and LIGO.
The SIGO is space-based, right?
Sorry?
The SIGO is space-based?
The SIGO is space-based. But I don't think it's, I mean, it's not something,
no.
There's no proposal at all. I mean, it's just could fill the gap, but it's not, perhaps if it will happen, it's a long time from now. But in principle, there's proposals to fill exactly the gap between those, and you could think about doing multi-band gravitational wave search for bosons. I can try to explain all these curves and points. I have to say here, it does seem that the noise is very small here, 10 to the minus 28. If you know the LISA noise curve, this is actually really small. It's not the LISA noise curve. This is a LISA noise curve weighted by a duration time, which was 2 years, by it's perhaps a very unrealistic, but because the SNR grows with the square root of the time, of the observation time. What we plot here is the AST over the square root of 2 years, just for illustration. And so these vertical lines are basically for a fixed initial spin of the black hole, 0.9, just for illustration. And for different redshifts here, we didn't think it, this doesn't include, for example, galactic black holes that here would have a much higher amplitude. So 0.01 is roughly 40 megaparsecs, I think, up to 3, redshift 3, and you have these, so the frequency is redshifted due to basically the, well, you have the redshift of the frequency, because they're farther away, so you have the redshift, cosmological redshift effects. And along these lines, so each of these points correspond to one choice for mu is this alpha parameter, so m, the mass of the black hole times the mass of the axion. So the larger for this spin, the larger is this mu, the larger is the amplitude. So this peak corresponds to roughly 0.3, I think for this spin, 3 something. And it, in general, it grows basically with alpha, the amplitude of the gravitational waves. And what you see is that the amplitudes are very large in general. So I already heard that you could have several events in LIGO, both in LIGO. And I will, if I have time, how much time do I have? Actually, I think I
don't. You have time, don't worry.
In LISA, in principle, also, you could have some results, some events. But I overplot something here, which are basically these curves that they, you do have all these events that you can resolve, but as we know, there's also much many events, a lot of other gravitational wave sources that we don't, we're not able, they are below the noise level, and they form, they sum up incoherently to form a stochastic background, which is kind of, in the detectors will be seen as noise, basically. But there's ways to detect this background for the kind of sources that need something really important. So I had to suggest, because so the stochastic background, of course, depends a lot on the astrophysical models that you use for the to predict the stochastic background. So I just wanted to just say that for this, to compute them, we use, so for LISA, we use these models that I was talking about from Enrico Barraus. For LIGO, we used, well, here, I will only show extragalactic stellar mass black holes, but it's basically a models by Irina Dvorkin and collaborators that they had models to predict the background from black hole binaries, and that included also predictions for basically the mass function of stellar mass black holes from only core collapse, and takes into account, for example, the fact that you have a redshift-dependent or time-dependent star formation rate and metallicity. So it takes into account the fact that nowadays and in the past you didn't form the same kind of black holes. The caveat here is that this model doesn't predict spins. So
what
we
did you assume?
So what we assumed was different spin flood distribution for the spin from 0. From very like really high spin from 0.3 to 1 up to 0.5 to 0. So while LIGO was already say that for to resolve event, LIGO is mostly sensitive basically to galactic signals. So what we did was also to compute the background that comes from all the extragalactic sources, which, as I will try to argue, must produce a very large stochastic background. The way normally stochastic backgrounds are plotted or shown in terms of amplitude is through this quantity, omega GW, which basically measures the fraction of kind of energy in gravitational waves over this critical density, is the critical density that will basically close the universe or not. It's proportional to the Hubble constant square, just to make this quantity dimensionless. This is roughly also, you can, it's given by this formula that you can find in standard textbooks. It's equivalent to just taking all the black holes that are unresolved and sum the amplitudes of all these sources, and you can these quantities you can relate to omega GW. So this quantity just measures basically the sum, incurring sum of all the sources that you cannot resolve. So that's why you're with SNR smaller than 8. So the spectrum that you need to know the spectrum, basically, the mass function and the birth rate. So this is just cosmological factors. And this is, yeah, so because these are, here it's assumed that the universe is isotropic, homogeneous, so this is actually only valid for exogalactic sources. And the spectrum is roughly, because this spectrum is very the waves are very monochromatic, the spectrum is roughly, it's really well described by basically a Dirac delta around some frequency. That's a frequency of the source, and that's basically you have a redshift effect because I'm considering extragalactic sources. So at larger distance, the frequency goes down. And the normalization factor, you can compute it just by basically taking, you do know the DDG, so all the clouds dissipates in gravitational waves, and you can just integrate in time. So delta T, what we chose was basically, we wanted to try to include, for example, imagine that you have a merger while the cloud is dissipating that will destroy the cloud. And you wanted to also somehow include basically accretion timescale. So what we decided to do, perhaps this can be done better, but I think it's as conservative as we could at the time, and this T naught is the age of the universe. So it's basically the minimum time between either having mergers or, so if you have a merger, this time is basically quite short at the time where the merger happens. If the signal is larger than the age of the universe, you cut the signal at the age of the universe or the age of the binary if you want. And basically and this comes directly from the models, all these numbers, and you can just compute the total energy that is emitted by by each system, and then sum up everything and compute the stochastic spectrum. And what you get is quite, so if you're familiar with what you normally get for example, binary black holes, this seems quite large. So binary black holes, for example, in the LIGO band, right now the estimate is around 10 to the 9, minus 9. So perhaps observable with design sensitivity, well, here LIGO 5 will be design sensitivity, and these are basically O1 and O2, etc. LISA, you'll have also stochastic background in LISA, which is quite large. And actually in LISA, it's so large that here, if you transform that in a noise, in LISA it could even like be larger than the noise floor, in the sense, at least at some frequencies, in the sense that it will also add up to the noise, because the stochastic background will be quite large with LISA. Not so much for like.
When you do the stochastic background, you take into account that probably there is a peak. Usually stochastic searches assume that you have a flat omega GW. Mm-hmm. Did you check to see if the fact that you expect here the omega GW to be centered around the central frequency set by the mass? Did you check to see if that improves the sensitivity, or did you just take the omega GW, that sensitivity that's coded by?
Actually, it doesn't include the galactic ones. Because the problem with that we had with galactic, it's first how to compute it accurately, because it's not homogeneous and isotropic, so there will be direction effects. Apart that, there's a problem that they will be peak all at the same frequency. So while extragalactic ones, so this effect that you see here, the fact that it goes through a range of frequencies, is just because it's just redshift effect, just a cosmological redshift.
Still peak. This is what I'm saying. I'm saying that should help with the search.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
So it doesn't help obscure, because usually people assume when they code sensitivity on omega GW for GW, for they think of a phase transition, so the distribution is flat.
Mm-hmm.
While here, there is a feature in the spectrum.
Yeah.
Even if it's smeared, it's still kind of peaked, even if you
see,
you see what I'm saying, right?
So actually, I spoke with some people and they say it could improve the church in the sense that it's a quite, it's spiky and very unique, different from very unique feature, which is different than what you would expect.
Yeah, did they say, did you
Yeah, so there's some, I cannot say much, but there's some people that are looking.
Well,
I cannot say much because it's.
I can say, so we usually assume it's a power law.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
The usual search is either quote upper limits on omega GW, assuming a given power law. So if it's CDC, it would be negative 2/3 or something, this phase of transition, something different.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
We can also marginalize overlap, but the bottom line is that we are assuming that it's something that it goes like that. And so.
So
you might want to look at, if you inject something like this, how do we record a given?
Yeah, so, and the thing, I know that there's someone working on that. I cannot say much more because it's LIGO. I don't know if I can. Well, it's part of LIGO, so I don't know what I can say about it. But he's doing this exactly the same tests about injecting and see whether you can recover and what you can.
Okay, great.
So there are some studies on how well we can distinguish different spectral shapes, not motivated by this, some methods paper by Callister and Thrain and all.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
If you inject like a broken power law or something, and for LIGO, the bottom line, they were thinking of weak backgrounds and we couldn't really tell the difference. But maybe for something as loud as this, it does matter.
Yeah, so.
So in these kind of cases, for these kind of models, what's the strength of the galactic versus the extragalactic signal?
Sorry, can you...
What's the strength of the overall galactic versus extragalactic signal in these models?
Yeah, I believe it's going to be... So first, it's going to be larger in terms of amplitude, but because it's really one frequency of a very narrow compared... So if you look in terms of stochastic background, perhaps the SNR will be not... Because you're not looking... You're kind of stochastic background, that's why I don't understand. You look at different frequencies and you have resolutions which are not that small at the moment. So
I mean, if it's got larger overall amplitude integrated over frequency,
it
still show up more in those. I'd naively have expected, unless it's doing something somehow smoothing, that even the stochastic background search, if you just average the power within a broad range, is still dominated by the galaxy in these cases.
Yeah, but
the overall frequency integrated amplitude should probably be larger.
Mm-hmm. No, I believe you. So we didn't look too much into that because mainly, well, one of the reasons is that we didn't know Twendell something as a very specific frequency.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's different from. Like from the galactic one is a bit different from, for example, well, I don't have the plot, but you know, like the one that I showed about the galactic white dwarfs, for example, they're all in the galaxy, but it's a different kind of search, I believe. So that's why. But in any case, even the extragalactic is large, and so much time. So I have.
Do you have time?
And so.
So
I just wanted to show kind of a back of the envelope estimate why. Even though, of course, there's model dependence, and I didn't say all these different curves are different spin distributions, basically. And here is also different, so because the low mass regime of the mass function for supermassive black hole is very uncertain, there's also different choices for this part. Even though there's some uncertainty, there's at least some arguments that you can make about why it must be large. Larger than the usual, for example, binary black hole background. And the reason is first, so as basically I tried to emphasize at the beginning, is that the fraction of the mass of a given black hole that goes to the boson cloud and then is emitted in gravitational waves is quite large, or at most 10% of the black hole. And if you compute for these populations that we had, if you compute the average fraction of energy that is emitting gravitational waves, is really large. It's around 1%. So it's a huge number. And so roughly speaking, the stochastic background is basically you can compute it as the fraction of all of the energy in the world population that is emitted in gravitational waves. The fraction that is emitted of the population that is emitted in gravitational waves. And for black holes in the Lisa band, for example, that's roughly the density in black holes. It's around 10 to the 4 solar mass per megaparsec squared cube. And if you plug in the numbers and put 1% here, you get around 10 to the minus 9, which is roughly what we get with some spread. For LIGO, the way we thought about doing this kind of back on the estimates is to look at what is known about black hole binaries. So first, black hole binaries, the amount of gravitational waves that is emitted in the black hole binary is around 1% of the total energy of the population. And binaries that actually merge in a fraction of less than the elbow time, that actually merge in the LIGO blend, are around, roughly, that's a very rough number, 1% of the total population of black holes that exists. Well, you have black holes that never merge, black holes that are completely isolated, etc. And so, the background for binary black holes will be roughly the fraction of black holes that merge, and then you can compute the fraction of energy that these black holes that merge that they emit. And if you plug in the numbers here, basically just take the ratio of the background that you would expect for axions and for binaries. These roughly given, these basically given by these fractions, these fx being the 1%, and you get 100 roughly. And so the background, and since the background in binaries right now, it's believed to be around 10 to the minus 9, 8, it can be a bit smaller depending on the models. The amount of the background for boson clouds should be roughly 100 times bigger in terms of amplitude. The spectrums will be different. For Black hole binaries, they follow power laws that go through a more frequencies than just kind of picked in a small range of frequencies. But the amplitudes must at least be roughly 100 times bigger than what we get for binaries.
So the mass density of black holes in LIGO band and in the VESA band, are you assuming they are the same in this argument?
Sorry, can you repeat?
So you have this rho BH, right? So you have one estimate for the rho BH in the VESA band.
Yeah, no, here I'm not assuming this for LIGO. What I'm assuming is just, so rho BH is the total amount of black holes that exists, density in black holes. So here for stellar mass black holes in LIGO. FM is the fraction of all these black holes that actually merge in the orbital time, which is, according to some estimates, are roughly 1%. And FGW is the amount of energy from all this population that is emitting gravitational waves, which roughly 1% is smaller or bigger than that. And so because this is the same for axions or for bosons or for binaries, if you just divide these by the background for binaries with the background for bosons, that's what you get.
So rho BH does not depend on mass, it's about the mass. Yes.
Yeah. Well, it depends, but it's the same population for axions or for bosons or for they cancel out when you take the ratio. You see. So I was just saying, we do know what we expect for the background for binaries. That's why we decided to do this way. We just wanted to know what we should expect for the bosons compared to the binaries. And if you do that, you expect it, 100 times bigger than the binary background for binaries because of these arguments, if they are correct. Okay. this is just resolvable sources. We already saw that the other day. So because when it is computation, we have the resources also to do basically compute the resolvable sources that was already been done by people here in the audience before. The numbers are consistent with here. I'm showing you because yesterday was mentioned the sensitivity depth. So of course the number of events that you will see basically depends on the sensitivity depth of the search. But the bottom line, the punchline that I wanted to kind of bring up at the end was, in principle, if there's a massive light boson in the right mass range, meaning for LIGO, let's say 10 to the minus 12.5, for LISEN, 10 to the minus 17, we will see it unless we are doing something wrong, given the predictions that these these models, and we agree with them. And so to conclude, basically, I'm not going to read this again, but to conclude, I think now that we have all these, it will be nice to start joining all these different channels that you have and actually starting with real data, given the audience, and to convince people to start constraining the parameter space of these actions. And thank you.
tons of questions.
any final questions or comments?
Yeah.
Okay, let's go to lunch.